going to call Franco, Ireland to discuss. Elton Miller, Mike Brown, Bruffman, Israel Inger Pendrak, and Brown sponsors Stephen Lee and Lisa Wise, Jonathan D. Tanner, Yudin and Derek Frager, Ellen Page Nockinson, Susan Layton, Josh and Tal Weinberger, David and Michelle Margulies, David and Sharon Chase, Jonathan and Ilana Gottfried, Irene and Rick and Joe Ellis, Richie and Janice Fine, Ron and Marguerite Warren, Sherman and Susan Frager, Jordan and Susan Holman, and the Peskin family as well. Thank you very much. Okay. Tarragon, you still... We hold it a mitzvah when you bring in a scholar in residence to make sure we fulfill the Aveir of Osir de Baba Farach, not to give him a moment's rest. But Rabbi Tarragon has passed every endurance, and it's to our great benefit. So if he's still able to stand up and speak, it's once again a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Tarragon, which is the topic of the Osir potatoes.
Sorshi?
Yes,
Okay, Shavuot Tov. This is lovely. It's really nice to get together for Lava Malka. The subject matter may sound a little bit, I would say depressing, but certainly on the eve of Asar B'Teves. Asar B'Teves is a day we commemorate part of the fall of our Mikdash, and not just the fall of a building, but the shift in history that has landed us in Lower Merion in the main line. We weren't meant to be here. We're meant to be in Yerushalayim. And unfortunately, we're climbing our way back. It's also a day in which many people commemorate victims of the Holocaust, Yom HaKadosh HaKlali. So it's only appropriate that as we begin the week, obviously it's a very short fast, it's something which sometimes can get lost in the flow of the week and the workday, and ends by 4 or 5 o'clock. So I thought it would be a nice idea to speak about processing anti-Semitism. And of course, the events over the last couple of weeks, local events in Pittsburgh and in general, the growing tide of anti-Semitism, not just in America, but in Europe, and I'll talk about that a bit later, to understand the roots of anti-Semitism, how to process it, where does it come from, and how to respond to it. Rabbi Sacks once compared anti-Semitism to a virus. Unlike a bacteria, which has self-sustained homeostatic capability, a bacteria is capable of conducting homeostasis, a virus is a parasite. A virus has to feed off of his host. The virus doesn't have internal homeostasis. And anti-Semitism is very similar in that it always has to produce a narrative to justify itself. It can't just exist in a vacuum. So when we first introduced monotheism to this world in the days of ancient paganism, when people worshipped stars and planets and trees and fish and seas and oceans, and we stood for a transcendent other god who couldn't be described in physical and visual terms. So we were hated because we challenged the world to higher ground and we represented something beyond their imagination. And then, miraculously, but not unexpectedly, the world converted to monotheism. In the 6th century, Rome becomes Christian, right? Beginning of 7th century, 6th century. And about 150 years later, the other part of the world becomes Muslim. And essentially, we succeeded. I mentioned this last night. It's important to remember as we approach Christmas, as people are celebrating their Christianity. From a historical standpoint, we view the impact of Christianity and the impact of Islam upon the Jewish experience through very, very, very tragic lenses, the persecution, the suffering. But if we decontextualize it and outside of the historical context, these are welcome developments. These are developments that transition the world from ancient idolatry to a world of ration and a world of monotheism and a world of more or less, obviously Christianity still has residual paganism to it, Islam much less so. Most Rishonim felt that Islam was pure monotheism. There are corrupted elements within Islam, the militantism, the aggression, but essentially we live in a far better world than our ancestors. People are no longer, by and large, worshipping Eitzvahevan. They're no longer worshipping trees and stones. So as the world turned monotheistic, a different narrative had to be spun to justify anti-Semitism. And the narrative was no longer hating Jews because they're monotheists, but hating Jews because we killed Jesus and we murdered the Son of God. But I forgot to once again ask Mishusim Rabbi Steinberg, and once again, thank you for being so welcoming. And that lasted for about 1,000 years, 1,200 years. And as I mentioned last night, In the 19th century, organized religion began to collapse, and it was no longer popular to speak in terminology that was patently religious, or at least classically religious. And of course, the 19th century, men began to think about race and genetics and evolution and the competition of races and survival of the fittest. And that intellectual milieu spun a whole new form of anti-Semitism, racial anti-Semitism. We were sub-Aryan race, and Hitler cast us as a inferior race. And that was not appropriate, but it certainly matched and was in sync with the discussion and the conversation of the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And now we've passed through that process and that stage, and it's no longer PC to speak about differences of race and ethnicities, and we all share 99% of our DNA, and a new story has been spun. The story of the Jews as colonialists and imperialists who are imposing apartheid persecution upon the downtrodden. And this is the age of the underdog and the age of equality and the age of protecting the rights of those who are vulnerable and innocent. And it's become collapsed. And I'll talk about the collapsing of anti-Semitism into a more global conversation. And it's become geopolitical. And Rabbi Sacks legitimately pointed out it's all just anti-Semitism being masked by different cultural, intellectual milieus and cultural geists, but it's still anti-Semitism. And it starts at Har Sinai. Chazal tell us source number one, Rav Chisda, V'Rabba Bered Rufuna, Da'amri Tervayu, my Har Sinai, this mountain has many names, Chorev, Har Elokim. Why was the name Sinai chosen? Why did it stick? The Gemara says in Shabbos, Har Sheyarda Sinai L'Umos HaOlam. That was the moment that anti-Semitism was born. I won't say born, the moment it was distilled. I'll talk about its birth a little bit later. But that was when it was crystallized. And as Jews, we believe in metaphysical forces that we can't trace, that are driving the human experience, that our cognition or our ration can't necessarily identify. If you interview the average anti-Semite, the average skinhead, and you ask him, why do you hate a Jew? He will not tell you because God chose them to represent him in this world, and I feel challenged, and therefore I despise them for challenging me to higher ground. But we believe that there are larger forces driving our world. We can't prove them, we can't detect them, but we know they exist. Not the world of physics, the world of metaphysics. And we challenge the world. We stand for our HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we stand for morality, we stand for family, we're the whistleblowers, we're the conscience of the world. We stand as the fortress, as I'll mention in a moment, against the forces of evil in this world. We're hated for that. I hope that, in part, this Shabbos has given you a sense of not just who Rav Lichtenstein was, a Rebbe, one of my Rebbein, who I think is much more familiar to the American audiences, but who Rav Amital was. Rav Amital told us the story of Mendele. Mendele's job in the shtetl was to wake everyone up during Chodesh Elul for early davening and for slichas. And he was relentless. He was merciless. He would knock on everyone's door and pour water on them and shake them out of bed. And by the time Erev Rosh Hashanah time came, Mendele was exhausted. So everyone's saying Slichos Erev Rosh Hashanah, and Mendele's Fashlofen during Slichos. Adam Defaktach, and he's Fashlofen. So everyone takes their crumpled paper and roll it up into a ball in the shul, and they start tossing it at Mendele to wake him up. And Mendele looks at everyone all bleary-eyed and exhausted. He says, I'm exhausted. Can't you let me sleep a little during Slichos? And they all look at him and say, Mendele, you kept us up all Chodesh Elul. You think we're going to let you go to sleep now? You kept us awake the entire month, and now we're going to let you sleep? So Rav Amital told us, we're the Mendele of the world shtetl. We kept the world awake for 2,000 years. We didn't let them decline into savagery. We didn't let them fall into idolatry. We challenged them. We were their conscience. We always prevented them from savagery and barbarism and immorality. They always looked at Jews and they saw family life and religious commitment and faith and integrity. And now all we want to do is go to sleep. We're at the end of history. We just want to go to sleep in our country. And they're all saying, Mendele, you kept us awake for 2,000 years. You think we're going to let you go to sleep now in Eretz Yisrael? Now it's our turn to throw some things at you. And unfortunately, we're suffering, but that's our function in history. We're the Mendele of the shtetl. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu prophesied this to Avraham Avinu. Again, I apologize that the source sheet may be a little bit out of order, but source number 15, Vayomer le'Avram, Yadoa, Teda, Kiger, Yiyazaracha, Ve'eretz lo lohem, Vavadum, Ve'inu asam, Arba me'oshana, Ger Yiyazaracha isn't just a geographical reality, it's not just a place of residence, but we'll always be the other, challenging the world to higher ground, challenging the world to believe in Ribono Shel Olam, challenging the world. And that's our task, that's our mission, that's our glory. And in a general sense, outside of the purview of anti-Semitism, one of my concerns is that in some sectors of the Orthodox world, we're losing that universalism. We're becoming very nationalistic and very parochial. And for a Jew, the two are the same. Every blot of Gemara we learn is meant to advance the world. And I told the story last night on the plane ride with that person who asked me what makes Judaism different from other religions, the professor at MIT. And I mentioned one issue last night, that we have a direct transmission from Har Sinai. A second issue I told that professor from MIT is I told him, do you know that for every Christian, you have a bullseye on your back? Because his messianic endgame, his eschatological endgame, is to convert you to Christianity or to eliminate you as the infidel. And for every Muslim, you have a bullseye on your back, because his endgame is to convert you to Islam or to eliminate you as the infidel, and Islamic fundamentalism has already begun to advance that agenda. A Jew has absolutely no conversion agenda. We have absolutely no interest in converting anyone else in this world to Judaism. We do have an interest in heralding a utopian world of V'yedal kol pol ki ata pialto, V'yavin kol yitzur ki ata yitzarto. And when that world comes, no one will be Jewish, but their entire world will be improved and advanced. And the same people who are defaming us and denouncing us, they're not our enemies. They're our audiences. As much as we have to defeat their message, we can't detest them as people, we can't become misanthropic, and we can't become xenophobic or bigoted, because our task is to live the legacy of Avram Avinu, the Av Hamon Goyim. And these are people we care about deeply. And unfortunately, we're not yet at the stage of history where our national agenda and our universalist agenda can overlap. They still clash. I live in the West Bank. I completely and truly believe that I'm advancing a universalist agenda. I don't think people in the UN would agree with me, but I completely subscribe to the notion that every inch of Eretz Yisrael that I settle will advance Mashiach and herald prosperity and welfare for humanity on their own terms. Not because I'm converting them to my ideology, but because, well, let me phrase it to you otherwise. Okay, you may throw me out. You may not invite me back for this challenge, but it's a mental experiment. Give me time. If you had 24 hours, and for the next 24 hours, you had a choice. You could enter a laboratory and solve cancer, or you could settle another hill in the West Bank, or learn a blot gemara. What would you choose?
Second.
First. Okay, let me explain myself. At a certain way, in a certain perspective, solving cancer would be a selfish and petty choice. Because if I solve cancer, I could eliminate suffering for arguably 100 million people who suffer cancer in some way, shape, or form, their family. But if I advance Mashiach and the divine introduction or intervention in our world, I could re-landscape this world and eliminate poverty, hunger, warfare, cancer, diabetes, AIDS. I could create a perfect world for all of humanity on their terms. So it would be selfish for me to solve cancer when I could try to completely revamp our world. Now, the real answer to that question is I agree I would solve cancer, but because there's a different variable that I haven't really introduced, and it's not just nationalism versus universalism, it's also pragmatism versus supernaturalism. I don't know that settling a hilltop will necessarily advance Mashiach. I do know that entering the lab through human endeavor and human faculty will solve, if I had that guarantee. So that's the real answer. But if I knew that my blot gemara would introduce the Ribono Shel Olam's intervention tomorrow, I could solve every single illness through a very seemingly national experience, a parochial experience. And it's so important, I feel like the Jewish world in particular, the Jewish world in general is becoming very, very bifurcated. There's some people who are hyper-universalists. They abdicated some of that national identity, and people who are embarrassed about Israel and embarrassed about the settlements and embarrassed, and because they feel denounced, and they feel that their experiences are not universalist enough. And I think sometimes in our communities, in the Orthodox community, we're becoming very, very parochial, very sometimes xenophobic, and very dismissive of other people. I have to apologize because I have to speak tomorrow in Toronto, so I have a very early flight. They asked me to speak about language to high school children, and one of the issues they asked me to speak about is bigoted language, because they feel that some of the kids are just very disrespectful when people walk into the building and they call them all sorts of epithets and dismissive language. And I feel like there isn't enough of a not just an appreciation of the other, but that's our responsibility to carry the world on our shoulders. We are Kodesh Baruch Hu's people. We advance history. We are the agents of the Ribono Shel Olam in this world on behalf. It's not as if there are 14 million Jews and the rest of humanity are just straw figures occupying some sidelight to history. They're Tzelem Elokim, and Kodesh Baruch Hu has interests for them, and we serve their interests. And this task is woven into the metaphors in Sefer Bereishis. In Sefer Bereishis, there are three metaphors by which the Jews are compared, or to which the Jews are compared. The first metaphor is, of course, they're compared to the stars. Source number three, Samti Zaracha Kafar Haaretz, Asherim Yuchal Lishlam Nelsa Safar Haaretz, excuse me, that's the dust, but source number five, Harba Arbe Zaracha Kechochve Hashemayim, Bekechol Hashel Svasayam, we're compared to the stars, we're celestial, we live above the rules of nature, we aren't subject, we aren't necessarily influenced or governed by the classic. Who would have thought that 70 years into our history as a state, facing homicidal enemies on every single border, recovering from the Holocaust, all of a sudden our state would become a superpower in almost every sector imaginable, economically, militarily, culturally, politically. Am Yisrael operates on a different rhythm, on a different Ein Mazal Yisrael. The laws that govern humanity don't apply to the Jewish people on both ends. When we suffer disproportionately, and when we triumph, we rise meteorically. Our life can't be charted or graphed based on typical sine curves of anthropological development. We're just a different people. When Moshe uses the word Echa, and Yirmiyah uses the word Echa, and Yeshaya uses the word Echa, and it's a rhetorical state of being perplexed. How can the Jewish people suffer so miserably, and how could we rise so dramatically? So we're compared to the stars because we have our above history. We occupy two realms. We live on this earth, but we also occupy the heavenly sphere. We're compared to the Afar Haaretz, source number three, V'samti Zarecha Kafar Haaretz. And that speaks to how multiple and how plentiful we are. And Chazal already sensed that the Afar contains a sad commentary about the potential for Jews to be trespassed upon and trampled upon. Source number four, the Medrash. Misamti Zarecha Kafar Haaretz, line number three. Ma'afar Asuya Dayesh, Af Banecha Asuyim Dayesh. That we're violated, we're trampled upon, we're downtrodden. But yet we outlast, in the same way that dirt outlasts all the feet that walk upon it, beginning of the Medrash, Ma'afar Mevalis Kli Matachos, V'kayim Le'olam, Kach Yisrael, Kolov De'kachavim V'teilim, V'hem Kayamim Le'olam. So we're compared to the stars, and we're compared to the dirt. But we're also compared to the sand. And very often people conflate dirt and sand. And they're very similar, but they're very different. What added component is conveyed by the metaphor of the sand? The Kachol Asher Al Svasayam. Source number five, Harba Arbe Zarecha Kechochve Hashemayim V'Kachol Asher Al Svasayam. To understand this metaphor of Chol Asher Al Svasayam, we have to go back to Parshas Bereishis. The entire universe was covered in water. And that covering of water was associated with Tohu V'Vohu. V'Ruach Elokim Merachefes Al Pnei HaMayim V'Aretz HaSov V'Vohu. Void, abyss, untillable, chaos, unlandscaped. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in two different acts of separation, carved out space for human habitat. First, he separated the upper waters from the lower waters. He established a firm plate to maintain that stability, the Rakia. And then he separated on earth between water and dry land. Yikavu Hamayim, I think I quoted the Psukim, source number 8, Vayamar Elokim, Yikavu Hamayim, Mitachas HaShemayim El Makom Echad. The entire earth, the entire terrestrial plane was covered in water, having been separated from the upper waters. Kadosh Baruch Hu carved out Yabasha. All the water should condense, all the water should be contained into what we would call oceans, and dry land should appear. Meserah Yabasha, Vayikra Elokim LeYabasha Aretz, well, the mikveh amayim, the contained waters, karayamim, the various oceans. Without this carving out of space, human beings couldn't exist. We couldn't live. We're not aquatic. We're not Aquaman. We can't live underwater. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to create space. However, that space is always under pressure. And when you walk on a beach, you sense the seam between the Tohu V'Vohu of the original waters and the dry land. And the sand acts as a sea fortress. And it's a dramatic sense. You see the tide rising, and then the tide receding. And you're witnessing a cosmological drama as to whether that decision of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's to create dry land will be preserved, or the waters will overcome the land. And every once in a while, we realize how frail and how brittle that boundary is in a tsunami or a hurricane or a tidal wave. As I think David HaMelech writes, a very famous section, source number 7, Gevul Samta, famous parak in Baruch Hinavshi, describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's creation of nature. Gevul Samta, HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates a boundary. Bal Yavarun, Bal Yeshivun, Lechasos Aretz. Hashem creates that boundary. Rabbi Soloveitchik believed, Api Kabbalah, that that ecological drama of the sand preventing the waters from overcoming not just dry land but human habitat is reflective of a historical and moral drama. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu separated the forces of void, the forces of evil, and those forces are always, as we would say, waiting at the gate, threatening to overrun humanity. And we are the Jewish people who are meant to prevent evil from trampling human experience. We are the sand. We are the sea fortress of humanity. We are meant to stand against those forces of evil or void and chaos and preserve civilization, preserve human experience, preserve the Yabasha. We are sand because we bear the crashing impact of the waves of that void. And we protect humanity from being overrun. And that's why Yirmiyah, it's a very interesting section in Yirmiyah, when he berates the Jewish people for their betrayal. Interesting, if you didn't hear what I just said, you wouldn't understand this pasuk. What does Yirmiyah, what does Yeshayah say? I'm sorry, Yirmiyah, source number 6. Ha'osi lo tirao, you don't fear me, no Hashem. Im yipanai lo tachilo, you don't quake, you're my people. Asher samti chol gevul layam, why aren't you afraid of me? Because I created the sand. What, we should be loyal to Hashem because he landscaped the beach? It's a complete non sequitur. Just say, because I spoke to you at Har Sinai, because I provide for you, because I've been. Asher samti gevul layam chok alam v'lo yavrenu v'yizgashu v'lo yachlu. Just like I protect human habitat from the waters, v'hamu galav lo yavru v'la'am hazeh hayalev sarem moreh zero. Hashem is highlighting, I expect you to behave like the sand. And just like the sand is committed viscerally, doesn't have a will of its own, you should follow suit. You should perform that sand-like function, and you failed me, and therefore Yirmiyah is berating them. We always stand tall in the face of these seemingly indomitable forces that threaten humanity, and we have the capacity to disclose to the world that these are not really, that no human convention can overcome God's people, and we prove to them that they're paper tigers. Nebuchadnezzar, at a very important juncture, I alluded to Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah last night. Nebuchadnezzar, a very important theme of history. The Jews have been exiled from Eretz Yisrael. Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar seems to be invincible. He builds a six-story tall idol, and he demands that every single culture send an emissary to prostrate themselves in front of the idol, and no one dares defy Nebuchadnezzar. Except for three unknown Jews named Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. We don't know who they are. They come from nowhere. They're anonymous. They're John Doe's. I mean, Chazal fill in the blanks. They're Nevi'im, but we don't have any recorded history in Tanakh. And we laugh at Nebuchadnezzar. Your idols and your six-story tall towers don't intimidate us. And according to Chazal, Lanu Hashem, Lanu, they recite Halal, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Don't save us for our sake. This is a very, very delicate historical moment because your glory has been desecrated and your mikdash has been despoiled. And if we don't reinforce your presence in this world, you could recede. Lo lanu Hashem, lo lanu ki'im l'shimcha tein kavod al chastecha ve'al amitacha. The Gemara Misachim says this is what they recited. And when they emerged from the Kivshanai, they said, Halu Hashem kol goyim, shabchu kol omim. We did it. Now the entire world, Kol Goyim, Shabchu Kol Omim, is now able to appreciate that you're still here, despite the smoldering Beis HaMikdash back in Yerushalayim. And what happens within a few months? Nebuchadnezzar becomes a raving lunatic, wandering the forest half-naked, and the entire Babylonian Empire collapses. Yeah. Who would have thought? The Babylonian Empire was built to last 1,000 years. No one dared defy them. And who knows from Babel? Babel disappears off of the map. The night of Belshazzar's party, he's ransacked by the Persians, and the entire sphere of influence shifts to Persia. Because a few Jews stand up to Nebuchadnezzar and prove him to be that paper tiger, that house of cards. Most of the people in this room, at least some of the people in this room, are old enough to remember how much fear we lived in, how long we lived in fear of the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc. And I remember I had an uncle who got caught in the Soviet Union. You know, no longer for him. Most of my family escaped. There was one woman who remained behind. My uncle Jakob came to visit me in 1972. I remember sitting at my kitchen table. I was quaking under the table. Came in his Russian uniform with his red stars and he barked at me. I thought he had a nuclear bomb in his suitcase. He gave me a little toy Russian tank and I was so proud. I brought it to school. 2 days later, it ran out of batteries. So I ran to the drugstore to replace the batteries. But it was a Russian battery. It was a square Russian battery. I had to toss the tank. And who dared defy the Soviet Union? Who dared defy the Soviet Union? A few Yidden. Nathan Sharansky and his chevra. We refuse to be intimidated. We refuse to be suppressed. We're moving to Israel. At some point, it will happen. So when does he cross Checkpoint Charlie 86? How long does it take for the Soviet Union to collapse? 3 years? What's 3 years in the span of history? It's a hiccup. He proved to the world. It's a beautiful pasuk. I saw this week. That's why I added this pasuk. The Ishbitz quotes the pasuk, source number 18, and twice in the end. Such a beautiful pasuk. Ki mireyam yikar eson, Hashem says, I will eliminate all the forces of evil. The kovi Hashem him b'yushu aretz, and those who anticipate the Ribono Shalom will inherit the earth. But listen to this pasuk. The od ma'at ve'ein rasha. The evildoers will disappear v'hisbonanta, and then you'll consider it al makomo ve'einenu. They never existed to begin with. It was only a facade. V'hisbonanta al makomo. You'll think about what place they occupied in history. V'einenu. Not that you'll defeat them, but you will prove that they never represented a threat to begin with. It was all a veneer. It was all a mirage. V'hisbonanta. You'll consider al makomo. The Soviet Union will be relegated to an asterisk in history. Just as Babel is. And I think unfortunately, we're playing that same role now. We're the first culture and the first country to call terrorism for what it is. It's not subjective perspective of the downtrodden, and they're not gunmen, they're not militants. And I think the world in general is going to pay a very, very steep price until they arrive at that clear-headed, lucid sense of right and wrong and criminals and victims. And sadly enough, I don't say this with any degree of triumphalism. And I think that the great swirl of moral subjectivism and moral relativism has led to a lot of confusion. I call it one of the bastard children of democracy. We've drunk the democracy Kool-Aid. We're so enchanted with democracy, and there's so many consequences negative impacts of democracy. And one of them is if everyone has an equal vote in the ballot box and everyone must have an equal moral voice at the conversation. It's not true. Just because you have an equal vote doesn't mean that everyone's perspective is morally equal. And we're falling into that trap of moral. There are aggressors and there are victims. And there are people who are hiding behind innocence and tunneling into our land and with desire and intent to maim and murder. And there are those who are trying to protect civility and to protect humanity. And I think we've lost some of that, not we, but I think the world has lost that clarity. So anti-Semitism is woven into history, and it's woven into the metaphors that HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers to Avraham, and it's integral and inherent to our challenge and our task to represent Hashem in this world. And I think the consequences or the connotations are twofold. First of all, it's not random. It's historical. It's unique. I think, as I alluded to before, and I felt this very powerfully after the Pittsburgh massacre, that people are collapsing anti-Semitism into a broader discussion of racism and bigotry and discrimination against African Americans and homophobia and race relations. And all of those issues are important. We should be at the forefront of those conversations as well. We should protect the vulnerable, and we should protect those who are despised and derided. It's certainly part of our challenge as the children of Avraham Avinu. I mentioned last night that when I live in Israel and I look at a secular Israeli, I feel the pulse of the Rabbanu Shalom's capacity that a Jew has to love land, people, and history, even without attachment to ritual. And when I see a Reformed Jew or Conservative Jew in America who may not even have that capacity, but is firmly committed to moral crusade and social justice and social, that's also a glimmer of Avraham Avinu, to worry about those in need. And we should validate that and embrace that and try to advance that. I think that's still, we're still B'nai Avram, we're still Rachmanim, Baishanim, Gomlei Chasadim, and those who pursue that, even if it's absent of any ritual and it's absent of any commitment to land and history, and even if they're embarrassed by their state, at least there's that sense that they're continuing the legacy of Avram, you know, and that's still part of their Yadus. You know, Judaism is not a single variable equation. There are layers of our Yiddishkeit, and we try to broaden our Jewish identity as deeply and broadly as we can, but we have to be able to discern and to celebrate and to validate even partial layers of Judaism in people who don't present in the classic way. And sometimes it's more difficult to appreciate their Judaism. That's number one. I think that we have to avoid in our own minds. I don't think it's disappearing. I think there's a naive notion that if we just were enlightened enough and understood each other enough and educated enough and sent everyone to the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, and all of a sudden anti-Semitism would disappear. It's woven into history. It will only completely disappear. That shouldn't render us fatalists and shouldn't render us enfeebled. We should still try as hard as we can to mitigate and to limit and to address it and to educate. And certainly, I think the struggle in Eretz Yisrael isn't disappearing. I don't think there's any magic plan that will all of a sudden resolve the Palestinian issue. But as best as we can, if we can save even one life or one heartache, on either side, a Jewish life or a Palestinian life, it's our responsibility to protect life and to respect life. And as much as we can, we want to try to crusade on behalf of mitigation. But this naive sense that human beings can change the course of history and create these panaceas or airtight solutions, this is woven into, we are the Mendel. We challenge people. We continue to challenge people. And hopefully, as I said before, we could limit the contentiousness and the adversity. But I don't think it's something that can disappear. And as I mentioned this morning in Shul, it's a question of whether you flee from Jewish history or embrace Jewish history. I'm not going to say chachlu b'chas, I'm happy when there's an anti-Semitic incident. Chas v'shalom, people suffer. But I understand it. I understand. I don't expect when, let me put it into different terms. I didn't choose to live in a lone shvut because I was pursuing a life of convenience and luxury. I chose a life of what I thought was prophetic impulse, a prophetic compulsion. I feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to live in that country and wants us to extend the frontiers of our society. And whatever hardships I face, whatever difficulties, they're reconcilable because I'm trying to impose prophecy on a world of history. And those two are yet to fully match. They're yet to be synchronized. The world still isn't ready for that synchronization. And I expect there to be rough edges, and I expect there to be. I'm not happy when they occur, but to a person that lives a life, sometimes when I look at secular Israelis, I ask myself, how do they process it? How do they process the fact that we just want to be a regular nation living quietly, and yet we're hated, and the disproportionate treatment in the news and the BDS? I know how I process it, because I don't expect the world to embrace it. I expect the world to oppose it. The world knows subconsciously Yerushalayim is the origin of humanity and the epicenter towards humanity. To me, it's completely rational from a prophetic standpoint that Jerusalem is so contested, more than Balakin word and more than Lower Merion, because that's where history began, that's where history will conclude, and humanity has a deep subconscious longing to return to its root. And I'm not happy that Jerusalem is so contested, but to a degree I am happy, because humanity is longing for that return that I'm advancing and crusading on behalf of. Chadish Emeinu Kekedem. One of the primary differences between Western view of history and the Jewish view of history is Western civilization views history as open-ended, progressive, advancing towards an unknown endpoint. And Judaism views history as cyclical and predetermined. We're returning to the terminus. We know where history will end. The only question is how soon we'll get there and whose shoulders will carry the process to its terminus. But we know where we're heading, and when Yerushalayim is so coveted and contested, to me it's humanity reaffirming the nevuas that HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered to us, that people will struggle and contest for Yerushalayim and want to be. And they want to be in Yerushalayim, and at this point, they don't yet have the voice to express it in peaceful and friendly and collaborative manner, so it's hostile and it's challenging. But so I think the attitude is crucial. And again, don't whitewash the experience of ideology. There's real suffering that goes on, and we have to try to protect ourselves and protect people. And I sometimes feel very uncomfortable with highfalutin ideology, whitewashing tragedy and suffering. And sometimes in Eretz Yisrael, when people suffer, it's immediately spun into prophetic imageries of where we are in Akos HaYamim. And there are real human beings that suffer, and there are people in Pittsburgh who suffer. And even if we don't suffer at a practical level, we have to try to stabilize our experience and create protected and safe environments. But when these things flare, they're not random, and they're not incidental, and they're not based on geopolitics. They're based on deep-seated historical realities that are woven into the fabric of humanity and our role in humanity. And number two is there are a lot of repeating factors, or repeating cycles, and this helps us appreciate the historicity of anti-Semitism. I just wanted to mention just a few of them. Number one, when the Rambam in the 12th century wrote his famous letter to the community of Yemen, famous letter, Igeres Teman. It's a beautiful, beautiful letter, and I think it really, I recommend reading it if you can. And the community of Yemen was facing a hostile wave of anti-Semitism, a false messiah, and the dashed expectations of false messianic announcements had created. And the community was sunken into a real depression. So he wrote his letters to lift their spirits, the Chazek Yadayim Koshlos, the Bukayim Koshlos. He wanted to try to strengthen them. So he quoted a pasuk in Yeshaya, source number 9. Kol kli yitzar alayim lo yitzlach, v'chol lashon tekum yitach la'mishpat tarshi, zos nachalas avdei Hashem, mitzitkasem me'itinu om Hashem. Rambam noted that this pasuk has two components to it. There is the weaponization and the aggression of weapons, kol kli, and Hashem promises us that all weapons that are hurled against us will fail, kol kli, yitzar alayich lo yitzlach. But then there's also the verbal assault. V'chol lashon takum itach la'mishpat tarshi. All tongues that are hoisted against you will be indicted. Chol kli lo yitzlach, kol lashon tarshi. And the Rambam reminded the community of Yemen that historically, we will always be discriminated against and persecuted on two fronts. They will attempt to persecute, and they will attempt to physically murder, exile, discriminate, exploit. But they'll also try to demoralize us verbally and to defame us with their tongues. And again, in the Rambam's time, it was theological verbal assaults, the great trials of Judaism. Just imagine living throughout history. I remember about 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, I went to Prague with my wife. And someone said, just whatever you do, don't go to the Charles Bridge. Just avoid the Charles Bridge. Well, telling me not to go to the Charles Bridge is essentially punching the ticket. First thing we did right after the plane, we went to the Charles Bridge. What was there? There was a statue of Jesus. And a Jew had blasphemed in the 13th century at Prague, Jew from Prague. And his punishment was to adorn the statue of Jesus with gold letters spelling the sentence, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. It was very, very offensive. That was the best part of my trip. Because I was 3 hours away from Eretz Yisrael, and I was able to withstand this insult to who I was. It wasn't a joke, because it was very somber and solemn, but I can get on a plane in 3 hours and return to Eretz Yisrael and reinforce who I was and my belief system. But I just thought about all the Yidden who lived in Prague for the hundreds of years, passing by that affront on these cobblestone roads and being downtrodden and being... Have you visited the Altenai Shul? The famed Altenai Shul in Prague that I've heard so much about, storied, legendary shul. It's a hovel. It makes this look like a palace, this room. It's a hovel, it's dank, it's dark, it's mildewy, because Jews weren't allowed to build palaces to Torah, because the cathedrals and the squires and the churches had to be the tallest buildings and the glistening gold towers. And I just thought about all the Yidden who passed by that idol for 500-600 years and still maintained the faith and the commitment. And they didn't have Eretz Yisrael to reinforce and to strengthen their resolve. And I just felt so humbled by their energy. And I remember I was told, this was when I first started traveling, that I can't wear a kippah in Prague, there's anti-Semitism. I felt so cowardly with my hat on. I remember taking my hat off and I threw it into the Charles River, the river. I said, I will not disrespect the Jews who walked on these streets by concealing my identity. And since that point, I've never worn a hat in Europe or in Dubai. I can't. I'm finished running. I'm finished fleeing. We've run through history. We're home now. I am who I am. Either accept me for who I am. Again, I guess if it were extremely dangerous, I don't think the situations are necessarily dangerous. I think much of it is psychological. Obviously, if I knew that it would lead to Sakanas Nefashas, I'd have a Chiyuv Minotara to conceal them. And I just felt as if... So the Rambam was commenting on people that were facing it. Imagine just living, especially this time of year, and everyone in your community is mocking you and scorning you and defaming your religion. But the Rambam couldn't have known that in the 21st century there would be a different meaning to this pasuk in Yeshaya, one which, with all humility, is a lot more literal. Because the Rambam was talking about theological verbal assaults. What are we facing? No one is attacking Judaism, they're attacking our morality. They're attacking our ethics. You're an apartheid state, you're racist, you're abusing, you're hypocritical, you're the nation of God, you're children of God, you stand for morality, and look at your abused Palestinian citizens, Palestinian. That's literally what's happening. If you read the pasuk, Chal Lashon Takumi Tach LaMishpat, they're literally litigating us in The Hague. They're literally calling us to justice and to judgment. And Hashem promises us, Chal Lashon Takumi Tach LaMishpat Tarshi, those voices will also be stilled. As I mentioned before, we have to separate the message from the people. The message is toxic, and the message is blinded by hatred. The people are our future subjects, our future audiences. You know, these are the people we're meant to care about, and that's the challenge of the year, not just to defeat them, but to try to convert them and at some point with the help of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So when we see BDS and we see the anti-Israel media, and trust me, I travel many, many locations, and the American audience has it a lot easier than those in England, and certainly a lot easier than those in South Africa, which has become ground zero for BDS, because that's where apartheid was defeated. And the anti-apartheid, the ANC, the African National Congress, literally shared office space with the PLO. They were literally joined at the hip institutionally. And if they can just prove, they can just equate Zionism with apartheid, then essentially the battle is won because the world has voted against apartheid. Apartheid has been defeated. People, there are Jews in South Africa who are literally committing day and night to defend Israel against tremendous, tremendous hostility. We have a lot of boys who serve in the army from South Africa, and we try to post pictures of our boys who serve in the army for the parents back home. We're not allowed to post pictures of South African students who serve in the army. Because in South Africa, there's a law that if you serve in a foreign army, you can be in prison, which has nothing to do with anti-Israel sentiment. It has everything to do with the fact that in the mid-90s, when apartheid collapsed, so a lot of the reigning white officers were displaced by African officers just for the sake of equality. So you had a lot of officers on hand that hired themselves out as mercenaries in the Bosnian Wars of the late 90s, and they returned to South Africa. And what do mercenaries do upon their return? They're drunk and they rape, and they're trying to limit their officers from becoming mercenaries and officers in foreign armies. But the BDS movement has exploited this, and they'll post pictures of South African citizens serving in the Israeli army on Twitter and on Facebook, and then they literally can become imprisoned. Or they can walk back and arrive home for Pesach and land in jail. You have to be very, very careful. So that's one pattern that repeats itself. The second pattern that repeats itself, Rabbi Soloveitchik talked about this a lot, is that hatred in general is psychopathic and self-defeating, and there's no hatred like the hatred of a Jew. And every year when we recite on Pesach, Rami Ovid Avi, Bayeri Mitzrayma, who is Lavan seeking to murder? His own children, his own grandchildren. What grandfather is willing is so contemptuous and so full of hate and anger that he's willing to sacrifice his own grandchildren. I'm reminded of the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. How many resources did they dedicate? They were fighting a war on two fronts. They were losing millions of soldiers in Leningrad and Stalingrad. And they're fighting the Eastern Front, the Western Front. And still, the resources they dedicated to hunting down Jews in cellars and ghettos and to find every last Jew. I don't know how the war would have ended differently if they had redirected some of those resources to either of the two fronts. And it was literally self-defeating and self-annihilating. that the hatred of a Jew is just so deep and so vicious, he becomes psychopathic. And hate in general is toxic and consumptive, but certainly hatred of a Jew. I think another pattern that repeats itself is that the hatred is not just psychopathic, but it tends to unite seemingly irreconcilable or seemingly very, very dissimilar forces. Think about the forces of anti-Semitism in America. Anti-Semitism tends to stem from white supremacist groups who feel that the national pride and character of America has been compromised by the foreigner, and the Jews are cast as foreign, contaminating influences. Well, that's the source of anti-Semitism on these shores. If you got on a plane tonight and landed in London, ironically, anti-Semitism is being driven by hyper-liberalisms, multiculturalists, who feel that the Jews are part of the globalists. I'm sorry, that in America it's a globalist, but it's the hyper-liberal German Corbyn who feel that the Jews. The forces of anti-Semitism in America and the forces of anti-Semitism in Europe despise each other. They would not sit at the same table. The liberal-minded progressives who see the Jews as colonialists who are abusing the underdog in Europe, as opposed to the white supremacists, or even the Arabs who are driving much of anti-Semitism in Europe, they couldn't sit at the same table with the white supremacists in the United States. You know, there's only one common denominator that unites them, the hatred of a Jew. And this already happened in Mitzrayim. First pasuk in Mitzrayim when Paro says, Hava nischak malo. It sounds like he's having a conversation. Hava nischak malo, source number 12. Vayomer elamo. Hava nischak malo. Hine am b'nei Yisrael rab yatsu mimenu. Hava nischak malo pen yurba. So as I'll say that he convened an admixture of different people to try to conspire against the Jews. Shlosha hayu be'osa etza. Bilam, Eov, and Yisro. Bilam, Eov, and Yisro. Three strange bedfellows who had absolutely no common agenda in Paro other than their contempt for a Jew. And interestingly enough, and you may miss this, one of the makot was retribution for this unlikely alliance against the Jews. Anyone want to guess which one it was? Which of the ten makos was highlighting highlighting the fact that unnatural forces congregate, Arov. Why is it called Arov, not Chaya? You would think it's called Chaya, wild animals. Arov means a mixture. And animals don't normally predate side by side. You don't have a bear predating alongside of a snake and alongside of a lion. And they all attack the Jewish people, and there's a source number 14. I just quoted a short blurb from the Medrash. Ve'od hevi aleh makos Arov l'fisha hayimur bavin. The continuation of the Medrash suggests that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was sending the Egyptians a message. You had collected unlikely forces. Typically, they wouldn't ally or wouldn't collaborate because you hated the Jews. So I will highlight this and punish you with forces that weren't normally predate side by side to remind you of your hatred. So I guess the general theme, again, I have to apologize because I have to really play through. The general theme is it's woven into history. The patterns repeat themselves. As I mentioned this morning, part of being a firm yid is that sense of history and the willingness to bear the glorious but difficult burden of history and not to be overwhelmed by it. And as I mentioned again this morning, a little bit of perspective and proportion with everything that we're facing and all the challenges in our lives. Just think of your grandparents and what they would have given to be in your shoes. So we're facing anti-Israel media. We're facing hecklers, we're facing DDS on campuses, we're facing anti-Semitic incidents. I'm not trying to trivialize chalila b'chas human suffering or human frustration. But sometimes we become a little bit too landlocked in our own small moments. When the boys are in yeshiva and they leave yeshiva, I say one of the traits I want you to walk away from yeshiva with is an interesting word. You're not going to find that in a Musar Sefer. You can open up Yisrael Hashem for humility and piety and Teresa Mitzvos and davening, but there's certain traits you can't get from a Musar Sefer. It's called verticality. If you're part of a lineage, you come from somewhere and you're plowing the road for someone that will come after you. You're part of history. I think when boys and girls come to Israel, that sense of verticality is awakened. When you're living in Chutz La'aretz, it's harder. I think adults can sense it, but I think teenagers can. You feel like you're a point. You're living in Baal HaKinward, your restaurants, your school, your sports. You're isolated. And all of a sudden, we're 10 minutes from Kevarachel, and 10 minutes from Arsimachel, and 5 minutes from Kevarachel, and people are sacrificing for our history. You're part of something, and you're happy to submit yourself to that larger historical process. So I think that just putting anti-Semitism into perspective, realizing it's woven into whom we are, realizing that it began at Har Sinai, it's not incidental, it's not because this Jew acted inappropriately, or that Jew cheated on his income taxes, or because Israel, God forbid, is settling his homeland. Our grandparents lived through it and lived with it. Baruch Hashem, Hodo Hashem, Kitov, Kiliom, Chazal. Look at what we have in our state, and our people, and our pride, and our affluence, and our security. And instead of the panic and the doom, it's a very, very thin line between precaution and panic. And we have to be very, very careful not to cross that line. And crossing that line is an abject failure in Emunah. Be very, very careful. And the Meraglim crossed the line. Precaution is one thing. And we've had to take precaution in Eretz Yisrael. There are times of greater precaution. But the panic and the heavens are falling, and that's a very, very dangerous place for a Maamon. And just because you're a Maamon doesn't mean you can ignore and act irresponsibly in the face of danger. Obviously, precautions have to be taken. But if this is the challenge to our Emunah, psychologically, to withstand some of the aggression and some of the protests and some of the dismissiveness towards our people, Ashreinu v'tov lanu, that this is what we have to face as opposed to our grandparents. And we should be not thankful that it exists, but have a little bit of perspective. And not disrespect those people who face far, far greater hardships with our own timidness and our own, not cowardice, but our own fears. Stand tall with what a Jew is. We stand tall in the face of history with a fortress against those forces. And we've defeated far greater enemies than those who are aligned against us. Far, far more intimidating forces. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects of us. I want to wish you all a Shavua Tov, a meaningful fast. And again, once again, thank you so much for welcoming me to the community. I feel like it's a very special kernel here that Baruch Hu has been blossoming. And it's continuing to watch it grow and to see its fruits and very capable leadership, Baruch Hu. And again, I want to apologize. I don't like to speak and walk out of a room, but I have to literally get into a cab very, very early tomorrow morning, and I want to try to get a little bit of red eye. She worked out.
Thank you, Rabbi Harrigan, very much for his very, very, very developed area of inspiration. Thank you again to all the sponsors, and I think the end point that you kept alluding to is something we all dive in for and look forward to.